Great. So we're happy today to have Kari Cesarotti. Kari is a PhD student at Harvard University, and today she will be telling about how to look for new physics in future muon colliders. Please take it away.
All right. Thanks so much, Christina. I felt very bad making her do that, pronounce my last name like that. But yeah, I'm Kari Cesarotti. I'm a grad student at Harvard. And today I'll be talking about sort of two projects that I've been thinking about, both in relation to how we can look for new physics at future muon colliders. So one is a project with a paper that came out kind of recently with postdocs Puya at MIT, Rodolfo here, and Sam, who's also a postdoc at Harvard. And then I'll finish my talk today with some work in progress that's being done with my collaborators at Harvard. That's Sam again, our postdoc Rashmish, and my advisor, Matt Reese. Okay, so certainly one of the biggest questions that we have as the field in phenomenology is, where do we look for new physics, right? And there's a bunch of different answers to this question, and certainly I don't want to pretend that this particular list is exhaustive, but certainly the LHC is a great place to look for new physics. It has enormous discovery potential, and I still believe that there's lots of potential for new physics. So some examples as to how new physics can be hiding in new kinematic signatures, I explore in this paper here with some collaborators at MIT. We can also search for new physics using precision experiments, like these tabletop experiments, like the Doyle group at Harvard runs. And again, some example of this, I wrote with my collaborators at Harvard, and Yuichiro Nakai, where we use precision experiment results to study very high energy new physics scenarios like SUSY completions. But also we could think of something like an intensity frontier, that if we just, you know, crank up how many particles we're colliding or what kind of target we use, we can just look for things with new couplings that are quite small that might otherwise evade us. And certainly there's tons and tons of other places we can look for signatures of new physics. But really, if our goal as particle physicists should be to expand this energy frontier into that 10 to EV regime, the best way that we can do it directly would be to construct some new colliders. So I want to consider not only constructing new colliders, but constructing mu colliders. Okay, so that's this talk, the physics promise of muon colliders. All right, so what's excellent about these machines is that they really are providing more of a complementary probe into both considering standard model and beyond the standard model processes. So here I just want to kind of paint the picture of the differences between these two machines. So for starters, at the LHC, what we're colliding is composite objects, right? And so because of that, the available center of mass energy is going to be less than the energy that we actually collide. Whereas at muon colliders, muons are not composite objects. Therefore, that full center mass energy is available in the collision frame. So just to illustrate how different these numbers can be, here is a plot borrowed from this nice paper that summarizes some muon collider things. If you consider the lab frame center mass energy of a muon collider compared to a PMP machine, we see that if we consider amplitudes with either like the same amplitude or something that's got enhancement due to the color options in QCD, it would take about a 14 TeV muon machine to reach what a 100 TeV proton machine could do. So really, if we want to go into this frontier, an excellent way to do it would be with muon machines rather than expecting PP machines, right? Okay, again, since we're colliding fundamentally different objects, a lot of what we can see at the LHC will have color production. So color charged particles and bosons are what's causing the primary interactions, whereas at muon colliders, we could really study more electroweak production specifically. So we'll be producing things that have more high quality electroweak events, which can again give us insight into both standard model and beyond the standard model processes. So we can also think of muon colliders to some extent as kind of an electroweak gauge boson collider too. Again, on that similar thread, because the LHC has all its color production, there will be a lot of hadronized final states, and that can be kind of a messy background to pull stuff out of. Whereas at muon colliders, we expect to see a much smaller QCD background. And then, of course, a lot of these arguments that I'm making are sort of generic for any lepton machine. So just to play devil's advocate, what if we were to consider building a future EE collider? And really the biggest difference here is that there's synchrotron radiation, which is going to fall off really sharply as a function of the particle we're accelerating its mass. So because muons are like 200 times more massive than electrons, the amount of synchrotron radiation in a muon collider would be so much less, so we can build much higher energy machines. All right, and then from a phenol perspective, what kind of interesting physics do we want to probe? If we're building something in an E plus E minus machine, we'll be most sensitive to these first generation couplings, coupled to electrons themselves and things that would otherwise be like phase-phase suppressed. However, at muon colliders, we're coupling directly to the second generation couplings. So models that might be suppressed at an EE machine can otherwise be probed directly. So beyond that, more promise for what we can use the muon colliders to search for is that it's really going to be an excellent physics tool to study new physics, specifically contributing to the G minus two anomaly. So again, my collaborator Rodolfo, who you all know, had some interesting papers with collaborators out recently, and they are promising that there will be a guaranteed discovery at future muon colliders, assuming that the muon G minus two anomaly persists, which so far as we've seen, it has. So they propose this really interesting no-lose theorem that there has to be something new at least the TeV or maybe 10 TeV energy scale if we were to build these machines and go look for it. So of course, I don't want to say that muon colliders are the only thing that we can do. There are definitely cons of a muon collider. First off, it's kind of hard to achieve a high quality beam because these muons are being produced by meson decays. So they kind of have a broad phase-space distribution when they're produced. And muons decay, they're not stable particles. So that can produce these beam-induced backgrounds by having these high energy decays occurring. However, we have some technology that can help us do the first one. I'm not a collider expert. I don't want to talk too much about that, but there are smart people who know what they're doing who can fix this problem. And in terms of the beam-induced backgrounds, if we sacrifice a little bit of geometric acceptance to install some shielding, we could basically reduce most of the backgrounds and still have quite a broad reach as to what we can see. So these are problems, but problems that we think we know our ways out of. And of course, there's been this really excellent community effort recently to explore the physics case of a muon collider more fully. So this is the Muon Smashers Guide, sometimes called the Pirate Ship too. Not sure how those two came together, but this is a really nice in-depth exploration of the physics case of muon colliders. And if you want to read more about it, I highly suggest that you check out this document. My collaborator, Sam, is on it as well. Okay, so really the punchline that I think muon colliders have is that these future multi-TeV muon colliders can provide a complementary and a robust physics program. So it's not like we're trying to replace existing technology, but we can see new things, fundamentally new things. So in the remainder of my talk, it's split into two parts. So the first part I want to explore is basically how we can improve our physics reach with this energy frontier by building a multi-TeV collider. So this is the work that I did with Puyo, Rodolfo, and Sam, and we consider a specific new physics scenario, which is vector leptoquarks. And in part two, I consider how we can use these muon colliders to probe the intensity frontier. And this is this work in progress, so a lot of things I'll show you are preliminary. But really the point is that if we go through the trouble of building this muon collider, what's the most physics potential we can get out of something like this? We can consider these auxiliary experiments like muon beam dumps that cost very little to the main collider physics program, but can really help us extend the reach of some other physics models as well. All right, so to get started, let me first tell you about these vector leptoquarks. And of course, at any time, feel free to stop me, ask questions as you please. Okay. So the leptoquarks model is a pretty generic and broad new physics scenario, and it's the term that we kind of apply to everything that can couple to both a lepton and a quark. So we're focusing on a specific kind of leptoquark, and that is canonically called this U1. So you can see up here, this U1 is defined, the gauge couplings of this U1 is defined to be a triplet under SU3, singlet under SU2, and it has a 2/3 hypercharge. So it's gonna couple to both gluons and the electroweak bosons. So these are a nice motivated model because they arise in a lot of completions, UV completions. They they emerge in these Patti Salam spectrums from grand unified theories. Especially this U1 is like the most fundamental one of this spectrum as well. What's nice about them from a phenomenological perspective is that they can address various flavor anomalies. So it's something that would coincide well with our current physics program. And then what's interesting about doing this at muon colliders in specific is that it would explore complementary parameter space to what's being done at the LHC. Okay, so at the LHC, we've been able to look for masses about like 1 or 2 TeV, but here I'll show you that we're able to probe much further up to about 50 TeV masses. Okay, so here is the minimal U1 leptoquark EFT that we consider. We're trying not to say things that are too specific to the exact UB completion. So here is our Lagrangian with the U1. So we have this kinetic term. And the kinetic term is interesting. It's actually defined using the covariant derivatives. So there are some gauge interactions that happen in this first term. We'll say it has some explicit mass. And then it's got a coupling to both the gluons and the electroweak boson field strength. All right, and then we have this extra term over here, which of course is the namesake, where we couple to both our quarks and our leptons. So this term is particularly interesting at muon colliders because it's how we can directly couple to these muons. All right, and then some other generic comments about this model. So we're assuming that we only have left-handed couplings, which I show in this term here. That's a choice. We could include the right-handed couplings. We don't kind of for the sake of simplicity, because we're actually able to account for any of these flavor anomalies only using left-handed couplings. But in theory, you could just rescale a lot of our results by kind of like a factor of 1/√2 to get the effect of having this right-handed couplings as well. We're also making this assumption that you have your hand up?
Yeah. So I have a question here.
Please.
What about anomalies?
What about anomalies?
Like yeah, because if you just add that, there is anomalies, right, under the standard model.
I see. So like standard model, okay, you're worried about that anomalies. So I'm assuming that the exact answer to your question would be depends on how we do the UB completion to try to make sure that we complete it in a way that there isn't anomalies. As I write it here is we're not saying that it is like the U1 gauge boson. We're just saying that it's a vector boson that has charge. So yeah, there could be some problems with anomalies. So I think it would be how we would fix that would have to be in the UB completion, which I didn't want to go too deep into now.
Okay.
That's not a super complete answer.
No, but the assumption that you just have this, it's not clear that, I mean, Patti Salam models, they have much more structure.
Right. Yeah. This is definitely a very simple EFT that does not paint the full picture. And there would have to be like, there's a lot of really rich physics in the UB that we're kind of being agnostic towards just to understand what the pheno of something like this would give us.
Yeah. And also you're assuming... I'm probably now guessing forward in your talk, but
okay.
For example, are you assuming you'll have some minimal flavor violations so that you don't introduce additional or also CP violation and things like that?
We don't explicitly, we see that there is some flavor violation that can be caused at tree level from leptoquarks. Mm-hmm. And we're just making sure that we're like sitting safely enough inside the parameter regime of what we have to make sure that we're not like surpassing those bounds that we need something to like reel it back in. So I will show you some tables later that might answer your question a bit more about that.
What about CP violation? There should be some CP violation here.
Yeah. So we're not assuming that there's inherent CP violation in this model. We were trying to avoid looking at the flavor constraints that required CP violation as well.
Okay, fine.
I might show a slide later that you'll have some more questions related to this on. Good. Yeah. Okay. So then again, going back to the idea that the UB completion is not something that we're trying to be too specific about. We assume that the U1 is a fundamental particle. If it were composite, this would rescale the couplings to these gauge bosons. So for now, we're just saying that it's fundamental. Okay, and then of course, to try to reduce some of the huge number of parameters that we have in our theory, we introduce some additional structure to these beta IJ couplings that I have here. Okay, so again, if we look at this coupling in specific, like I said, we set the right-handed couplings to be zero. And then for the left-handed couplings, we assume this structure of the coupling matrix. So first off, we're saying that the first generation couplings are already very well constrained by existing low energy experiments. Here's a nice review of those experiments. And so since we're not directly coupling to the electrons, we're just going to set these to zero and not be concerned about the effects from here. These couplings in the second column, so the columns correspond to the lepton generation. And these couplings will correspond to direct production, so things that can couple directly to muons. And then how the relative strength of these four couplings plays out is going to determine what final state is going to be dominant, and sometimes some of the internal structure of our amplitudes as well. So the kind of structure that we take when we're exploring this model, the free parameters of this model are just going to be, again, the couplings, and then the mass of the leptoquark. So in order to try to make this a little bit more tractable of a problem, we consider four distinct scenarios for our flavors or for our couplings. So in the first scenario, we turn on only this coupling, BL32. And so we consider this coupling for a specific reason. So the three corresponds to its coupling to a bottom quark. So bottom quarks are a little bit easier to deal with experimentally because bees have finite lifetimes and we can tag them. And then to the muon so that we can directly produce them. So this is our coupling of particular interest. And our first scenario is just scanning over a bunch of values of this particular coupling. In other scenarios, we base what we consider the other values to be on this value. So in scenario two, we just turn on the coupling of beta 2,2. So that's two strange quarks and muons. In scenario three, again, we're still leaving this coupling on and we turn on couplings to taus now as well. And in scenario four, we have everything turned on. Okay, so again, how big these couplings are affect the final states. Yeah.
Just a simple question. I guess you're working in the mass basis now for the fermions when you write down this coupling. So although it's maybe more, again, a UV-related question, like you're assuming that the pattern of couplings is similar to the Yukawa ones?
Yeah, that was kind of the onslaught that we had. I think there's some reason to believe that this beta 3,3 term, of course, I can't remember it at the moment, but I think there is some reason to believe that this beta 3,3 term should be the greatest. And again, maybe that's just inspired by the same structure of the Yukawas, that it's related to the mass and some UV completion. But yeah, okay. That's the kind of phenomenology that we were interested in.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going back to the statement that I made about what sort of flavor anomalies or flavor observables that we'd be interested in using leptoquarks. Here's a bunch of the summary of the low energy flavor observables that might be affected by these leptoquarks. And then on this right column here, we have what relevant couplings would need to be turned on in order to have a non-zero contribution. So for all of these values, we're making sure that, you know, we're just working in the parameter space that's still allowed and not going to be ruled out by measurements that we already have in the PDG. So in particular, one anomaly that gets a lot of attention is the RK anomaly. For those of you who aren't flavor physicists, it's just the ratio of B decays to kaons and EEs over K to mu mu. In our model, since we don't couple to electrons, there should be no contribution to the numerator, but the denominator gets this tree level contribution from a leptoquark. And then from our effective field theory, kind of borrowed from this source right here, this would be the bound that we'll set. So this doesn't mean anything, doesn't look like it means very much just sitting alone, but I'll show you where it shows up on our limit plots later on. Okay, so we consider three different production modes of how we'd be able to produce these leptoquarks at a collider. So So we have pair production, single production, and Drellion. In order to simulate these, we use MadGraph 5, and more specifically, we use the LQ-U1 UFO that was written by the flavor group expert. Okay. I'm not really going to go much into the single production just because it doesn't actually set a bound. So I want to focus a little bit more on the other two scenarios for production. Okay. So first one that we'll consider is the pair production. So when I say pair production, I mean that really there are just kind of two U1s that are being produced. They don't necessarily have to be produced on shell like some of these diagrams would suggest, but certainly there's going to be an enhancement when everything is actually on shell, right? Then for different scenarios, like I said, the different strength of the couplings will determine what final state we're interested in, what we look for. So for scenario one, we're really just considering the final state of B mu, even though there could be strange quarks, but again, a little bit harder experimentally to deal with. And for scenarios three and four, because that coupling beta 3-3 is so big, the primary final state is going to be the beta tau. All right, so then something interesting that I want to point out about these pair production is that we see for three of these diagrams, actually, we don't even need to include some beta couplings, right? Is the coupling to the U1s is directly to electroweak gauge bosons. So this will be just a function of that coupling and not of the betas. So the dominant way that it's actually going to be produced for some range of our couplings is going to be through this first channel up here, where it's the muons, like a Drellion-like process to produce two U1s in the final state. All right, so of course we're gonna have some standard model background to something like this. And I really wanna draw your attention to the second diagram here, because I think this captures more of the physics of what's gonna go on with the backgrounds. So when we're producing these backgrounds, it's going to be these lepton and jet pairs that are produced. And so these are actually quite easy to mitigate when we look at the invariant mass of these things, right? Because these should be produced, they have the biggest enhancement when they're produced near the Z peak. So the invariant mass of something like the diet muon pair should be pretty close to that value. So in order to mitigate the backgrounds, we do look at these invariant masses and then we can make a cut. So here I'm showing what the standard model backgrounds for this kind of pair process would be, where instead of mu mu to UU, B mu B mu, it's just mu mu to B mu B mu. And the standard model, unsurprisingly, is very sharply peaked at basically sub TeV invariant mass, which makes sense. But for the mass of the leptoquarks, for non-zero leptoquark contribution, I guess rather, there's not really going to be a correlation because again, it's the leptoquarks producing B and lepton, not the two of them together. So there's not as strong of a correlation in this invariant mass. So just by placing very modest cuts on this invariant mass for considering a 3 and 14 TeV muon collider, a cut of 0.5 and a cut of 2 TeV on this invariant mass is enough to dramatically reduce to like less than one event the amount of background. Yeah, Mina.
Yeah, sorry. This is the center of mass for the muon collider. Mm-hmm. I may be like jumping ahead, but how does this compare to high Lumi LHC in terms of reach?
Yeah, good question. So I'll show you that the reach that we can get is really between 1 and 50 TeV. So even for a high Lumi LHC, it would not be able to get kind of those tens of TeV mass range. It'd be much on the lower end. So okay. We're still a very complementary program to the LHC. Sure. I don't want to say that we're stepping on each other's toes.
Thanks.
Thanks. Nice question. Good. Yeah. So here's just a little bit more to visualize what's going on with this pair production. So here I've set the bounds for discovery and for 95% confidence limit from our pair production, again, assuming that we've done this cut on the invariant mass to remove background. And I just want to explain what the structure of this is a little bit. So this very sharp line that we see right here, that's when the coupling to the muons is so small that the dominant production is just the electroweak things. So it doesn't matter what the coupling is going to be, it's just a straight line because it's not being produced directly coupled to the muons at all. All right, and then something else that we should technically be careful about is that in scenarios one and maybe even two, because we only have that one mode that it's coupling to with the nuance, the lifetime or the width can be quite small. And once the width goes below lambda QCD, we might have to deal with some other hadronization effects that we're not accounting for right now. So I'd be cautious to accept our bounds for this particular scenario in this particular regime, but this is not an overall caveat. This is just specific for here. All right, and then here is a plot of our branching ratios. And again, just to drive home that we see when we're not producing these two U1s on shell is that we take a hit in the production. All right, the other main process we're considering is the Drellion. Maybe you're picky about how you define Drellion, but for me, I'm just saying two leptons to two quarks. Yeah, I see a question.
Yeah, sorry. Could you go back to the constraint plot?
Sure. I'll show it again, combining all the plots too, by the way.
Okay. I don't get why there's a straight line, which is vertical.
Yeah. So just to go back, it's primarily, can you see my mouse at all or no?
Yeah, I see your cursor.
So it's basically all coming from this diagram right here. So there's no dependence on that beta coupling because this vertex, we're not scanning over this vertex.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's just when that becomes dominant.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Next question. Yeah. So here's our Drellion. We only really have the standard model background process, but what's nice is that we have the T channel for our leptoquark production and an S channel for the standard model. Right, so the standard model is going to get enhanced near the Z peak, which we are nowhere near. And so we expect that since it's going to fall like a rock as 1 over energy squared, is that Drellion will actually have the best reach at these high leptoquark masses. That's where we'll have the most sensitivity. So to do our statistics for this, we take the additional step of first binning an eta for the eta of the outgoing B meson. We can see that there is some parameters that we get nice separation from the standard model backgrounds, but there's also parameters where we don't have particularly huge separation. So we don't really want to make a cut because again, we're still trying to be very agnostic at this point because we don't know where this mass might be. But it does help us out a little bit with the log likelihood statistics to first take this step of binning in eta to reduce our backgrounds. All right, so then as promised, here's the full thing. Here's all of our bounds that we can set. So I have drawn here the pair production, our Drellion, and our single production. So as you can see, single production doesn't reach as far as the other bounds, so we're not going to worry about it too much. And this is particularly for a center of mass of 3 TeV with a predicted luminosity of about 1 inverse Adelbarn. All right, so I have drawn on here the RK anomaly bound. So if we were to say that it accounts for the RK anomaly, the available parameter space is to the right of this line, to say that it wouldn't like over contribute to that anomaly. All right, and again, just our four different scenarios. So it's gonna affect what our final state is more than anything. Okay, and then I have a similar plot for 14 TeV. We see that the reach extends a little bit further in this case. And now for a predicted luminosity of about 20 inverse Adelbarns. So again, there's lots of nice available parameter space between this RK bound and the bounds that we would hope to set at these future muon colliders. So phenomenologically, it's a really nice thing to search for because there's motivation to believe it could be there and we're probing a range that's particularly interesting to other reaches of physics. So that's kind of the quick elevator pitch as to why we might want to care about leptoquarks in specific. Yeah, Mina?
Yeah, can you say a little bit going back, because I find it very, very confusing to just think about a single vector leptoquark.
Yeah.
Did you guys give any thought about how you would do this in a Patti-Salam and how you would get the right flavor structure that you need? And so have you thought in a sense about UV completions?
Because yeah, so I'm going to disappoint you. And the answer is no. Because we just took, I mean, like the U1 is just like, this one in specific with this representation would just kind of be like at the bottom of the spectrum, right? So if we were to start seeing new physics from something like that, our assumption was just this would be the first thing that would come down. And then of course, as we pushed further up into the energy, we would see more richer aspects of that UV phenomenology. So unfortunately, no, we didn't really go into the details of all the rich physics that we would get out of that spectrum.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, I feel like that's just a disappointing answer, but.
Yeah, sorry, it's just, I just cannot think.
That's what I got for you.
Well, the other thing is because you also require a very specific structure in the flavor matrix, right?
That's true, yeah. So the specific structure that we had was more so to try to like see what corners of the phenomenology we could get versus there's nothing that was super dependent. So I mean, like Drellian in specific only cares about the coupling, like there's only one coupling that shows up here, right? So anything that we say about the overall flavor structure is independent of the bounds that we can set with Drellian because it only cares about this beta 3-2 coupling. And then the other guys were really more so to just see, again, like what kind of reaches we could get if we assume that we still have some kind of perturbative coupling, but not things so small, there's no hope to see, period. And I mean, I guess the punchline, even though we are assuming something that's a little bit specific with our flavor structure, mm-hmm. is that the bounds don't change dramatically, right? Maybe a little bit more reach, maybe the T channel is a bit bigger than the S channel kind of thing. But overall, these are like pretty comparable bounds. So even though we do make specific guesses as to what it could be, we're not fully model independent, but I'd like to think we're model agnostic at least.
Yeah. The other question I have is, so if you say that going back to the LHCb anomalies,
mm-hmm.
so I guess they can be fitted also with this type of vector laptop work, right?
Yeah, so yeah, let me just pop back up to that. Yeah, here we go. My little, whoop. Oh gosh, too far. Here we go, okay. Yeah, so again, here is some summary of just flavor observables that we can see. The only ones that even like, basically like everything to the right of the curve is still allowed, right?
Yeah.
And the only things that set even like kind of things that are in similar order of magnitude mm-hmm. Were the RK. And then also the, I think it was the RD maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything else was like very, very, very allowed. Not
even
close.
I guess the question I have, I want to be like very optimistic right now and say, let's say the LHCb things are true.
Yes.
So what are the chances that you will have to wait for a muon collider to say that this is happening because of the vector laptop work? Let's take them at face value. Let's say they are due to.
Yeah. I would say that the right place to look for, if you wanted to say like, okay, this anomaly is like truly coming from this piece of new physics.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the vector leptoquark quark in this mass range is not like, it wouldn't be the thing that could account for all of it.
Okay.
So I also didn't say anything specific about G minus two, mm-hmm. because if you wanted this kind of model of leptoquark quark to account for G minus two, it would need to be in the lower mass range. It would need to be like at most one or two TeV masses, which is not what we're claiming to be sensitive to. So I would say that the LHC would be the thing that could address the LHCb anomalies with this stuff. And so when the high Lumi turns on, I think that is your best bet about like waiting to see if these LHCb anomalies are realized for the leptoquark quark or not.
Okay. I guess that's good news, actually.
Yes, yeah, great news. So rarely do we get good news in
part of thank you.
You only have to wait 10 years, not 40. Don't worry.
Yeah. I have a chance of being alive.
We'll see how this pandemic goes. All right. Dark humor. Excellent. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was the story that I wanted to tell about how we looked at leptoquark quarks. So again, the punchline.
Hi.
Yes. Hi. I hear some audio coming out.
Oh, do you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Now I hear you. Perfect. Okay.
Okay, so can I ask you something about flavor bounds? So in your plots, there was no flavor bound. Like, I don't know, like for instance, you have the BS2 mu mu in your table.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing, none of these things like show up. Or for instance, could you have like B to mu gamma?
B to mu gamma, yeah.
Because your thing like breaks B and it breaks mu number, I think, if I'm not mistaken, can you have B to mu gamma and then just look for that?
So if you wanted to have B to mu gamma, let's see. So I don't think you could get beta mu gamma with a tree level leptoquark process. I don't think that that would work.
I'm not sure about that, because the leptoquark can, it will be off shell, I guess. So the leptoquark will be off shell.
Right. You would need a direct kinetic mixing between the leptoquark and the gamma to make that happen, right?
The leptoquark has electric charge, right? So it can just speed off a gamma.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. So I guess if you don't mind having a leptoquark in the final state too, then.
I'm just a bit jarred that no flavor bound shows up in your plots.
Yeah. So I mean, again, the most similar process that would set a similar bound, I guess, is that if you just swing this strange quark down to the initial state, and so that's also something that would show up in terms of on our plots. But really, I mean, so it's not that they couldn't be used to address it. It's just that in the parameter regime that we're interested in, basically everything would kind of sit up here for the flavor bounds. Is that because we're thinking of something so massive, you would have to have a pretty strong coupling in order to be able to explain what the PDG has set so far.
I see. And would it be sitting there also with future projections from, say, Bale, EDCB, or whatever? Because it's a bit unfair to compare current bounds.
Yeah, it is. That's true.
Will be built in 50 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, definitely if things were to improve by even just an order of magnitude in terms of what if they were able to set, and then things would be a little bit closer to this RK line here. But basically everything on this plot is kind of unexplored territory, just because, again, the mass of the leptoquark is so much bigger. So anything at all that is in this plot is still potentially up for grabs to be explained by a leptoquark's presence. So I don't want to say that it can explain these. I'm just saying that the reach would, if we were all the way at the reach, the leptoquark would not be able to account for the full anomaly.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Yeah. So now that we've discussed leptoquarks, I want to take this time to give a little bit of attention to something that I think we could do in parallel to having this muon collider. And that is to explore the intensity frontier with considering an auxiliary experiment of a muon beam dump at the same complex. So what's interesting about having a muon beam dump in specific is that the energy of the beam used for the beam dump would be really comparable with anything that's been done before. And then, of course, having a high intensity beam dump run for a couple months out of a year for a couple years, that could really help us improve by a couple orders of magnitude some of the couplings going into that intensity frontier. So some of the things that are novel with a muon beam dump, really it's going to be good for new physics scenarios, right? Really weakly coupled things. So being sensitive to very weak couplings, that's just sort of a generic feature of looking at a beam dump in particular. Coupling to second generation leptons is something that's, again, a nice specific argument for a muon beam dump, because, again, things might be suppressed if you consider the first generation. And then being able to look at new physics masses with very small couplings at about 100 GeV, that's something that just couldn't be done at electron beam dump so far. So again, it's really these last two bullet points that are specific to why a muon beam dump in particular would help us reach into this territory of new physics. All right. So there's been a lot of rich literature proposed for electron beam dumps. This is kind of the holy Bible for looking at beam dumps, this paper by James Roman Philip and Natalia. And then there's also some efforts being done to consider how could we construct a beam dump and what would the physics reach be if we were to think about future colliders such as the ILC as click, FCCEE. And really, I apologize for any omissions of other beam dump experiments going on. But the general setup that people consider is that we have some beam that's being dumped out of the main accelerator. We have some target material, which is the actual beam dump, to block out, any extra backgrounds. We have some shielding or some veto. And then we have some fiducial volume that we expect our new physics to decay in. And then we can detect what these decay products are at the end. Right. So there has been an idea of a muon beam dump proposed before. And so this was done by Maxim and collaborators, where they consider using muon beam dump experiments at the Fermilab complex and at NA64. So just to give a little bit of insight as to what these are, and again, why we'll be considering something completely complementary. The beams at this are about 3 and 160 GeV, so different order of magnitude. And then the focus here was really on light scalars, so looking at something that could indicate two muons that are constrained by kinematics. There's just phase space not allowed. And these are really interesting because they can address the G-2 anomaly. So really well-motivated physics perspective. And then they're also considering kind of a small number of muons on target. So they're thinking of something like 10 to the 12, 10 to the 14, whereas for these proposed like ILC beam dumps, the number is closer to like 10 to the 21 electrons on target. So it's kind of a low energy, low intensity experiment that they can still probe some potentially very interesting new physics. All right, so this work in progress that I'm doing with my collaborators at Harvard is we're just trying to make some general physics argument for why we should consider a muon beam dump. So we're thinking about both vector models and scalar models, assuming that we get a multi-TeV muon beam. All right, so just to kind of parameterize the most general new physics scenario for some vector-like particle, to write it down in the most general terms, we have some field strength, we have some mass term, and then we have a coupling to leptons and neutrinos. So for some well-known motivated models of a new Z1 boson, we can consider like a dark photon-like model. So it kinetically mixes with the electroweak gauge bosons, and we have just couplings to the charged leptons. We also have to be a little bit careful because we can couple to quarks in this scenario too. And then we can have something interesting like an L mu minus L tau model where we just gauge the lepton number. This is an interesting model that people think about because there's no gauge anomaly when you introduce something like this. There's some arguments that it can contribute to the phenomenology of neutrino oscillation of masses and things like that. But what I think is really interesting about this L mu minus L tau model in specific is that one, depending on the parameters, it can also help alleviate some of these G minus two tensions. And being coupled to muons and tau specifically, otherwise we might only hope to see it through like loop productions of diphotons, if we were to think about it at like an electron machine or something like that. So it's kind of a hard theory to see at something besides a muon collider. All right, so our experimental setup that we're considering is we have some muon beam coming in, then there's a target material and shielding that should stop the muon beam. And then our new physics needs to decay somewhere in this fiducial decay region such that we can detect it. So again, we're trying to be not super specific as to what kind of final states we're expecting. So as long as we can have like dielectron or dimuon final states, those are the kind of things that we're thinking ballpark in terms of what new physics we're interested in. Right. So I've read in some models by like ship proposals and things like that, is that in order to get rid of a high energy beam coming in, you might want to have some sort of magnetic field set up in the shielding. Again, we're not that sophisticated yet with considering our experimental setup. So there could be some magnetic field, there could just be some very dense material, but the goal is that we really need to stop the muon beam so that it doesn't interfere with our measurements and decays happening in the fiducial region. So one reason why we think this might be feasible is if we go back to this general Lagrangian that I've written for you, and we think about this model of like a dark photon. Very roughly, again, to some order one numbers, the width of this dark photon should go something like the mass times the coupling squared times alpha enum. And then the lifetime of this kind of particle would just be gamma tau. So gamma is going to be a function of the kinematics of the beam setup. So it's just the energy of the particle divided by the mass times the width, right? So for the kind of thing that I've shown you so far, where we have like a TeV muon beam, the kind of space that would be interesting to look at, we see here, is that couplings of the order of 10 to the minus 6 and masses of the order of at least GeV would have lifetimes on the order of about 10 meters. So that's kind of exactly the right experimental scale that we would hope to find at this kind of machine. So this is a really nice flag that tells us that this is a promising kind of model that we can search for at this setup. All right. So the whole goal of these muon beam dumps is that you need to get a little bit clever with how you figure out how to actually calculate your number of signal events. So here's a horrible equation that I want to break down a little bit to demystify. So what we're doing when we calculate the number of signal events produced at a beam dump is first we need to consider what target material we have. So these numbers here, this is Avogadro's number, and then X naught has to do with the radiation length divided by this atomic mass of your material. We also need to consider the beam energy distribution. So if your beam is passing through a material that's comparable in length to the radiation length of your beam, then it's going to be losing some energy due to radiation processes. So you have to be careful to account for the fact that the energy of the muon emitting the new physics might not necessarily be the energy of the beam. Right, of course, we need to calculate our production cross-section, which I'll get to in a couple slides. And then also what's super important about these, the experimental setups of these beam dump experiments is that we need to have it be probabilistic that it's going to actually decay in this fiducial region. So that's why this calculation of the lifetime is such a nice indicator that these kind of models are feasible. So then to just define some terms that I'll use later on too, this variable X is the ratio of the energy of the new particle created divided by the beam energy. And again, we're assuming that it's about TeV range for a beam. So this probability is just a really simple exponential distribution. So this is mainly where the lifetime is going to show up in this computation. Oh, and sorry, yeah, so Z, I'll explain that too. Z is just the point at which it decays beyond the start of the target. All right, so in order to calculate what the production cross-section is going to be, what's happening here is that the production cross-section is from this photon exchange process. So our high-energy muon beam comes in, it sees an effective photon flux coming from the material as it passes through, and this can induce an emission of a new physics particle. Okay, and so really there's two diagrams here. You can have the emission before or after the transfer of momentum of the photon. So this is a 2-to-3 process. That's pretty tricky, but it turns out that we will be in the right parameter space to actually use the Weisseckel-Williams approximation. So what we can do here is that when we're considering a very high energy beam, this photon that is in the T channel here can effectively look like it's a real photon. So we can replace considering a 2-to-3 process with just considering an effective photon flux of what's coming in. And reduce it to a much simpler 2-to-2 scattering process. Right, so this approximation is going to be valid in the regime of first collinear emission. So the angle of emission has to be very small. And then everything needs to be very boosted. So everything is very forward is the whole point of this Weisseckel-Williams approximation. All right, so then just to kind of give you a sense of what this cross-section is going to look like, here's the hairy thing once we do this 2-to-2 scattering process. And so this chi here basically encapsulates all the information about the form factors, like nuclear form factors and whatnot, to tell you what the effective photon flux is going to be. All right. So just to show you that this is going to be producing boosted things and that this approximation is valid, I have plotted here x on the x-axis, which is again the fraction of energy in the new particle. And then the normalized cross-section distribution. So we see that when we have a beam of about 1 TeV and the mass of the Z boson or the Z prime boson is 10 MeV or 1 GeV, it's still going to be very boosted, right? Because 10% of a TeV is 100 GeV, still a very boosted particle. Right, and then one physics difference between this and something that we consider at electron colliders or electron beam dump experiments is that often people don't consider this term here that shows up in the denominator that affects basically where this distribution is going to peak. So at EE machines, the consideration is usually everything's just at x equals one, don't worry about it, not important to consider this distribution. But when we put in the muon and consider masses of new physics that are comparable in mass to the muon, we need to be sure to include this extra term. So then just to compare, this is again from this paper with Maxine and collaborators that considered the muon beam dump And we see that they observe basically the same kind of distribution. So good sanity check. The reason that's a little bit different is because they consider scalar models, whereas this is the particular dark photon model. All right, so, another new experiment. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a question. People usually say that the Weissacher-Williams approximation here is not valid for heavier Z prime bosons.
That's because they usually assume a much lower beam energy.
Okay, so just so I understand, yeah. that's the effect here.
Yeah, that's the big difference, absolutely. Yeah, but great question. Something that we for sure had to be careful about is making sure that we're working very safely within this regime, otherwise it breaks down and we can't use it.
But this mass term that you have, where is it coming from? Is it put by hand or?
No. Yeah, so I said that it's not put by hand, it's just usually, I have hidden from you like 20 pages of algebra to get to this point. So the pain and suffering that usually we put upon like first year grad students doing QFT calculations, right? To go through this, it's usually a much more simple process to just set this mass to be zero. You don't care about the beam mass, move on with your life. But because we're considering muons and because we're trying to look at things in the order MeV range, we just have to be careful about keeping that term. So if you were to go home and repeat this calculation, this is just my words of caution that you need to not set the muon mass to zero, no matter how much you want to. Okay.
All right, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so then one more new experimental challenge that's different from what we consider with electron colliders versus with a muon collider and therefore beam dump is that muons are very hard to stop. So in order to make this quantifiable, let's consider the stopping power of a material for muons. So for electrons, apparently there's this whole terminology about like, oh, we can say the words radiation length, but for muons, there's a whole different rule book. So if we consider the loss of energy as you go through a distance of a material, there are two terms, and this term proportional to the energy will obviously be dominant when we consider very high energy particles like TeV muons. So we can kind of think about this. It has dimensions of like 1/length. So this is like what we will use analogously to our radiation length. So just to give you some numbers, if you consider water with a muon beam of 1 TeV, it would take about 1 kilometer of water to stop a muon beam going with that much energy. All right, and if you take tungsten, which is what they propose in this other muon beam dump experiment, it would take about 30 meters to stop it fully. So really you have to have these very long experimental hulls, whereas for EE machines, sometimes you can have quite short things on the order of 10 meters in total. That's not gonna work here. So just for comparison about how different the amount of interaction is, the stopping power for electrons in water, it would take about 20 centimeters of water to stop compared to the 1 kilometer of water for muons. So kind of different experimental design needs to be considered. So here's, after integrating out all the terrible things in that old equation, here's kind of the punchline about what we need to calculate considering our number of signal events for this muon beam dump. And so this is our very preliminary experimental setup where we're just considering sort of the most basic things that kind of make sense. And of course, this is subject to a lot of probably optimization in the future. But for our 3 TeV muon collider, let's say we have a 1.5 TeV muon beam, we'll consider a target of water. Then we'll need 50 meters of tungsten to really stop that muon beam so that we can see the very forward stuff coming out of our new physics, right? So we'll consider a fiducial decay volume of about 100 meters, which isn't insane. Experiments at CERN like NA62 have similar length in their experimental halls. So it's doable, but it's, effort needs to be made to make sure that people know this is going in. Okay, so to give you a very preliminary idea about what kind of reach we can achieve with this is for our dark photon model, let's consider a couple different muons on targets. I consider 10 to the 20, 10 to the 22, and 10 to the 26, which again, looking at numbers from something like ILC projections, doesn't seem insane. So this is a very reasonable, to my understanding, projection. And these are the contours where we would get about 10 signal events. Then to compare, to actually sell you that, you know, this is new physics and we can reach new things, I superimposed it in perhaps the not most professional way onto existing muon data, or sorry, onto existing dark photon limits. And we can see that there's quite a bit of parameter space that we're able to cover that is uncovered before. And this is super conservative. This is definitely not optimizing anything experimentally. This is not considering the best kind of material to use as our target. This is just kind of right out of the gate, what do we expect would be the minimum amount of reach we can have? And we already see that we're making tons of progress here. So really, it's kind of a no-brainer. Pardon?
Sorry, but how did you calculate backgrounds for this?
So also an important caveat, we have not yet considered backgrounds, which is why we just put the 50 meters of tungsten in there to try to remove everything else that could even be showing up. So do we consider backgrounds? We don't. Not yet.
That's unclear to me because it's true that the tungsten will stop the muons, but it will stop them by... The muons will emit radiation. That's why they stop.
Yes.
So you will have like a really hot piece of material there, like emitting high energy photons that will make it to the target. It will be a mess.
Yes.
No?
So this is an excellent point. And if you go back to if we jump back to way in the beginning, looking at the EE experimental designs. Oh boy. Okay. Mistakes were made. Here we go, okay. So some experiments put in like vetoes specifically to help make sure that they're not just seeing all these super hot photons coming off as well. I think you're definitely right though. I think we need to put in a little more thought than just like, what is the piece of material that will cause muons to radiate all of their energy fastest? So some things we might want to do include like magnets to try to bend muons off course a little bit. So we're not just spraying our detector with all of these hot things. We might want to consider a veto. We might want to consider a different shielding. It's a great question, one that we have not yet answered, but one that we definitely need to answer before we publish anything concretely. So yes, thank you. Thank you for reminding us that we need to be a little bit more diligent with this, because so far we have not yet been.
Okay, thank you.
But what are you requiring as your signal? Is it muon pairs or?
For dark photon, because we're stretching down to here. Let's see. Yeah, because we're looking at something that's like 10 MeV. We're considering like either mu mu pairs or EE pairs for our signal for this.
Are you summing over all branch ratios of the dark photon, or are you just doing lepton pairs?
So for the lifetime calculation, we consider all branching ratios, but for just the signal, it's just the lepton pairs.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah, so we need to be a little bit careful about like hadron projection and things like that too.
I guess mu mu may not be such a huge problem unless Danielle had something else in mind.
Well, I mean, the photons are going to interact in the detector, and there's going to be, it's true that misidentification is maybe not important. I'm not sure, I just don't know. Also, I guess you can produce, those photons will be so energetic that, and there will be so many of them that I guess you can also produce muons on target. I'm not sure, maybe that's small because it's an electrolytic process, but still.
I don't think it's going to be negligible, because this is something that's of big concern for EE machines or like electron beam dumps, is that they have to veto those high energy muons coming out. So I don't think it's trivial. I don't think we can just ignore it. There's more work that we have to do to make sure that our experimental setup reduces background better. Yeah, I definitely don't want to say like, we've done it, our reach is fantastic, go us, right? I just want to say that, you know, if we're talking about muon colliders, there'd be so much missed opportunity if we didn't also consider installing a beam dump as well.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but thanks so much. These are really important points.
The other question I had was your MOTS. Usually people say POTS, but I guess you have to say your MOTS. Yeah. How realistic is 10 to the 26? Because I think of POTs usually in the order of 10 to the 21, but...
10 to the 26 is dreaming a little bit, I think. But I think that 10 to the 20 or 10 to the 22 is a realistic projection of what we could probably get. These are numbers that I'd really love to sit down and talk to an actual like accelerator physicist about what would be reasonable, because from the community literature, I think there's some confusion about that.
So these muons are coming from something, right? And that something would have to be at a, you know, at a rate greater than 10 to the 26. And if it's protons on target, then
probably would be coming from,
then you can probably already tell that you need more than 10 to the 26 POTs to get your mu OTs. But
ten to the 26 is probably dreaming a bit, but
But 22 is probably fine.
22 seems reasonable, right? 22 is not crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, great. So then, just to summarize, I know I'm right at an hour right now. The ongoing things that we're still trying to figure out about this is, again, optimizing this detector design and layout to do things like reduce background and just do physically reasonable things in general. We have a couple of different vector and scalar models that we're cooking up. So again, we can kind of create this template for experimentalists to take and run with. And then of course, the backgrounds. How do we deal with those? Still work in progress. But really, I just want to leave you with this thought that future multi-TeV muon colliders provide a complementary and robust physics program to what we already do at the LHC. Leptoquarks are a particularly interesting and motivated signal that we would be able to make some progress on looking at muon colliders in specific. And if we're going to go all the trouble of building a muon collider, building a muon beam dump would be an excellent, almost two for one kind of deal to see new physics. So thanks so much for your attention.
Thank you. Yeah, we can all virtually clap for Kari, and we can take more questions. If there are any, you already answered to a lot of questions during the talk, so thank you very much for that.
I have a very naive question.
Please.
Why did you consider only vector leptoquarks?
Just because it's very easy to put too many ideas into one paper. But definitely, what's nice about our vector model too is that we don't have any die quark coupling, so you don't have to worry about proton decay or things like that setting bounds. But in general, I mean, like, there's this really nice paper out by like the Zurich group, I think, recently, that goes into a little bit more about all of the different leptoquarks. And then we just applied it. We did the specific muon collider case for one of them, but they do general pheno for the rest of it.
Because one of your main signal modes was like T channel of a vector. And I'm assuming.
Yeah, for the Drellian. Yeah.
Yeah. The one where you have, I think, BB production.
Mu to BB with a Drellian or with a T channel of leptoquark. Yeah.
Yeah.
Drellian.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why I got confused, because usually think SG. Is it true that if you have a scalar leptoquark, that channel is suppressed? Because usually in T channels, you get like an enhancement in vector exchange.
Yeah. I would bet, again, I haven't done the calculation myself, but that would make sense to me that that would not have as far of a reach because you would have that suppression instead. I would definitely want to point you towards like the Zurich group, because they've thought about this in more detail.
Yeah, I haven't really thought much about leptoquarks, but yeah, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so actually I have a question about your dark photon reach plot.
Please.
Maybe if you can. It looks here that especially like for the lowest muon on target number, most of the reach you have it for larger couplings, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why the limit goes away is that the dark photon decays too rapidly, right? So it depends more on the geometry of your detector than anything else. So why is it that you have a boost in that direction? Like, you produce it with the highest energy, so it has the largest Lorentz boost, or like, I don't really appreciate why
one
collider would be better than an electron collider. Electron beam dump.
Yeah, I would bet that it's, like you said, probably more to do with the fact that, well, one, that we can produce things that have this higher mass because we are, you know, most of the reach is coming from a little bit higher mass. But in terms of the higher couplings, I think it's probably more specific to the experimental hall setup that I chose, where we have this like very long fiducial volume, so that there's more time for something highly boosted to decay.
I see.
But if you have, let's see, so the width of the dark photon is going to go with proportionally to the mass. So the lifetime is 1/(mass). So then when you boost, okay, I mean, so you would have like a, yeah, okay, the equation's literally on the screen. What am I looking for? But yeah, you would also, because we can probe these higher masses, you can suppress the length of decay. So this would be like, yeah, decay is like too far out, I guess, is where you would gain some of the reach.
I guess at larger couplings, it also decays farther away.
Yeah, larger couplings, then shorter lifetimes. Okay. Yeah, so then the boost would help, right? The boost would push it forward a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah, these are like conversations I have with myself like 10 times a day. It's like, was that? Okay.
Thanks.
No, thanks. It's a really like interesting consideration. Like why the whole question should be, why is a beam dump the right thing? A muon beam dump the right thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, related. I should probably know this, but what's the most abundant standard model particles that you produce on a muon beam dump? In terms of, for example, is it just pions and kaons or?
Yeah, so there could be, right, the kaon background could also be a problem because you're producing like potentially some kaons, then k-longs to get into your fiducial background. So I think like kaons, and then like Daniel was mentioning, like these high energy photons could also be kind of a problem for what backgrounds you would see with a muon hitting some kind of thick target.
Yeah, because I'm thinking usually in PP collisions you just produce a lot of hadronic stuff, but
yeah.
Does this mean that for a given mu OT, I just produce, let's say, a factor of 10 less pions? Is there a factor of 100? I don't really have a feeling for that.
Yeah, you'd have to look at, I guess like the right answer would be like to look at that R ratio, which is like the production of hadrons divided by the production of muons or something like that. So I feel like when you start to get up to like several TeV, it can be like a factor of 10 or 100 or something. Okay. Yeah, kaons is definitely something that we still have to be cautious of. K-longs in specific.
Yeah, no, I'm not even thinking about the backgrounds, just thinking about what you produce most often. I guess the R ratio doesn't really work because it's like lepton-lepton to leptons over. Yeah. This is like PP to, let's say, pions versus mu P and mu E to leptons. I don't really have a feeling for that, but it's probably easy to get an answer.
Yeah, I can't say I have super strong intuition for just what happens when you smack stuff into materials.
Because I would just think the reason behind this question is if you produce a lot of mesons, then you have also a neutrino beam, and you can kind of sell that
three
side
for
of
one.
This. But
three
I don't know if it's better or worse than PP collisions. It's probably worse, but
yeah.
I don't know how much worse.
Right.
Okay, well, we had plenty of questions, so maybe we can thank Kari again. Thank you very much for this very nice talk, and we can stop the recording.